Every once in a while, the skills you learn teaching freshmen help. what we've talked about so far is this hopefully not terribly vague notion of energy being the capacity to do work. I don't know about the rest of you, but I think myself and Kevin both have been very taken with Alan's story in this last couple weeks. Remember Alan's sort of basic framework that he's been talking about comes from Dan Erlander's Manna and Mercy. I was trying to figure out a frame to start the discussion about food for fuel. I've been really challenged, as I'm sure all of us have, who've been listening to this story of Manna and Mercy about how to deal with discussion of manna. A great way to start with this discussion of food for fuel. I've gone to what Dan here has written and Alan has talked about in Manna and Mercy. So we're back in the Old Testament wilderness school. So this is lesson one, Old Testament rules. God gives manna for all. So what happened was God provided the manna each day. This is the Exodus story. What the partner people learned was that all food is God. In fact, everything is God's. We own nothing. We can trust God for the other bread. What happened next? The people gathered manna each day for their clan. What the partner people learned is that work is the dignified activity of helping God's people, helping God meet the needs of all people. And I like that. The next thing that happened, larger clans gathered more and smaller clans gathered less. All had enough and no one had too much. What the partner people learned was that God gives daily food supporting is unnecessary. Food is for all, not just the big deals or the deserving. God deserves enough. All can therefore live in sufficiency with neither too much nor too little. So that is a scientist giving you what works for me as a Christian mandate for picking that up. So let's talk about food for fuels. If we move back into this text, remember, we're starting this as a food for fuels premise to be intentionally provocative. But I think it works. Let's go back to the triangle that we introduced yesterday. Remember, any sort of input into a sustainable solution long term has to think about the technology, has to think about the sort of economic framework that we assign to it, and the community issues. Keeping in mind the natural sources of energy and the social sources of energy. So I'm going to spend maybe 5 minutes talking briefly about the technology piece for biofuels. It's not that complicated. So some of you will have had snippets of it before, but let me give you just kind of a little bit, just so we have some language to discuss things in. Let's talk about biodiesel first. So the notion of biodiesel has been around a long time. Triglycerides are fats. When a triglyceride is a liquid, you can pour it, we call it an oil. When it's a solid and it sits, we call it fat. Right? So triglycerides are these hydrocarbon oils that we can react, in most cases, with alcohol, it breaks down the oil and forms biodiesel. Right? So the chemistry is pretty simple. Take the triglyceride and alcohol, a little catalyst, you get the biodiesel fuel. You also get glycerin as a byproduct. So the chemistry is not really intense. But what it kind of, what I hope you think about is that what we've done here is we've taken one form of energy, food energy. We've converted it into another form of energy that we're using primarily for transportation. So this would be one of our examples of fungible use of energy. Food and energy are linked in many, many ways. Not only this direct transformation, but the energy intensity of food has transportation, processing, packaging, marketing, kitchen prep. I mean, there's not only in that sort of biodiesel, but we always make these energy investments to get food. For those of you who are interested in this whole notion of the energy intensity of food, or just kind of a focus primarily on the natural energy arguments around economies, technologies, and communities, not in the triangle framework, but this is this book which we've, I think, should be in the bookstore today. Yes. We sold out last week. 3.0 is better than
2.0.
3.0 was there last week.
Oh,
exactly. And they're supposed to get more copies today.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah.
What's the title?
It is Plan B 3.0 by Lester Brown. And I really like his voice. Is a way of kind of talking through these issues that makes sense. Okay, so biodiesel, we talked about technology, relatively simple chemical transformation. Ethanol is even older. If we have grains, we can make them into alcohols.
Duh.
Yeah, right. Corey and I lived in Kentucky for a long time. Saw a lot of corn getting turned into bourbon. The chemistry is not novel. The interesting thing about ethanol, kind of the debate around ethanol, there's kind of two debates. The technical debate has framed around, is it even useful from a global warming standpoint? And do we get more energy out than we put in? And there, quite frankly, are very bright people on both sides of that argument. When I teach this at PLU, we kind of rip the articles apart and look at the assumptions. And I think I'm speaking fairly when I say that the scientists who are strident about, it's a waste, we're not getting as much energy as we're putting in, my opinion, right or wrong, is that they're taking a worst case view. They're assuming the worst case scenario all along, and that's the amount of fertilizer, think about that variables that go in, it's the amount of fertilizer you use, it's the diesel for the tractor, it's whether you think about the energy use for the tractor, it's the yield of the field. I mean, there's 59 different assumptions you need to make. And if you assume kind of worst case scenarios, it looks bad. The U.S. Corn Institute might be the most positive-looking voice, and they would say that there's a significant net benefit. Pimentel is the professor at Cornell, who's the most loud voice in that anti-camp. He would say 100 units of energy in, maybe 100 in, or for every 130 units of energy we put in, we only get 100 out, 30% waste. The other folks would say 60 and 100 out. That's pretty optimistic. I think that where the scientific community is kind of riding on now is kind of a reasonable kind of mid-range number would be that you've got maybe about a 20% decrease in global warming emissions. And if you're interested in seeing an article, it's the Union of Concerned Scientists did a good article on this, which, by the way, was in my Earth letter for Earth Ministry in our last issue. So I could send you to the Union of Concerned Scientists, but I could also send you to Earth Ministry. Look up Earth Letter. So the technical question here is whether we can make the transition from the corn that is somehow in our agricultural base. We can quibble whether it's maize or edible corn, but I think that's a quibble. Corn that's grown on agricultural land, or whether we can use cellulose. So all of us, unless we devolve a little bit and go back to the point or suddenly develop the ability to be ruminants, don't deal with cellulose very well. Mm-hmm. Cows do. And so the chemistry is... I won't go into, but it's really simple. I mean, it's a bond pointing up or a bond pointing down. Cellulosic starches that are inedible for humans. It's just a little chemical switch in there, but we can't eat it. calcium. And so if we can produce ethanol from cellulose, that looks good because it's not starting from a food source. It's less efficient, bigger technical hurdle, lots of questions about, you know, how you create a stable environment to grow these non-agricultural things like switchgrasses without fertilizers, leaving enough to get tilled back in to keep the land sustainable. But, you know, the, I would say a fair assessment is that these things look interesting. There's been great progress in the last few years. And so this is one that sounds a little bit like the hydrogen argument for yesterday work. There is a kind of nearer short-term potential solution that doesn't have the potholes that we think about in the food for fuel trade-off. And there's also a magic bullet in the biofuels debate. The magic bullet would be work that's borrowing on these genetic modifications and molecular biology tweaks of enzymes that will allow us to take any sort of cellulosic material, any biomass, and use sunlight and algae or enzymes to digest it to give off alcohols. So that work, by the way, is moving at a very interesting clip. If you want to dig, you'll see that the feasibility, the stuff that the DOE is funding there, they've got feasibility decisions like 5-6 years out. So there even is a magic bullet in the biofuels. Lots of research that I think we should support. Lots of potentially rosy future things. But today, we can't get around this argument that today, our plan today, this year, 8.3 billion gallons of ethanol from about 20 to 25% of our corn harvest. So 25% of the corn that we're planning on growing this year, which probably isn't going to happen because of the flooding in Iowa. But the plan was 20 to 25% of our corn going into this ethanol market, which, by the way, is enough for about 4% of our automotive fuel. All right, so Kevin will talk a little bit about scale arguments, but scale arguments are really important here. I talked a little bit about energy independence yesterday. Energy independence arguments for biofuels from corn make no sense. If we planted the land in corn for ethanol, we'd have about 20% of our energy. So I think that's probably the technology. There are magic bullets that would be nice if they work. We'll know in 5 to 10 years. There is this nearer term cellulosic route that probably makes sense. But there are fewer technical hoops to get there. And there's what we're doing today. In hydrogen, what we're doing today is we're making hydrogen from coal, making hydrogen from natural gas. Today, what we're doing with biofuels is we're making them from food sources. So the question is, where do we go with that? And I want to make that transition to, I want to move now from kind of the technology focus up into the economic front. Let me start the economics discussion with a, if you're all interested in very, very current discussion on this, last month in June in Rome, there was a high-level conference on world food security. The challenges of climate change and bioenergy. So this was a big deal conference. People from the UN, lots of countries, kind of talked about this. Let me just I'm going to read just two or three paragraphs that come out of this discussion. Quote: the current dramatic world food situation reminds us of the fragility of the balance between global food supplies and the needs of the world's inhabitants, and of the fact that earlier commitments to accelerate progress toward the eradication of hunger have not been met. This is FAO Director Tabak. Goes on to say that many countries are facing the dual challenges of sharp increases in food and fuel prices, threatening macroeconomic stability and overall growth. Poor food buyers in cities and non-food producers in rural areas who spend a large share of their incomes on food are the most diversely, or most adversely affected. And here's the interesting thing. Policy coordination is important in this respect. Production and trade policies on biofuels may need to be re-examined in the light of their possible effects on international food markets and hence on food security, especially in vulnerable countries. To be successful, decisions made and policies implemented in this area should take into utmost consideration world food security. So what I see as an economic frame here is very bright scientists, very well-meaning environmentalists, and sometimes, in some cases, saying that we see global warming as this issue, that biofuels is part of the solution to, we see this future out there that's not food-based. We are willing to move through this phase of food for fuel to get to cellulose, to get to non-food biomasses. No one in their right minds, I'll say it again, no one in their right minds sees a future of food for fuel. I don't know one scientist saying that. I don't know one environmentalist saying that. But I don't know what the discussion going on in the boardroom of ADM is. In fact, I can actually guess what the discussion going on in the boardroom of any large, huge food conglomerate is. This is a cash cow. We are going to, I know some folks in the Fortune 100s, and I think these people are probably choosing not to think about the consequences, holding their nose a little bit, and saying, stakeholder, shareholder value. Our goal is to make profit. It is our duty to our shareholders to take advantage of the fact that we have this opportunity. So let's get back to my frame for yesterday. There's no such thing as a level playing field. Economics, free markets depend on how we view the marketplace and the constraints that we put in the marketplace. Let's look at this marketplace. Let's think capitalists. If we look at the price of a bushel of wheat and the price of a barrel of oil, up until like the mid-70s, they're about the same, $2-3. For most of the petroleum growth era, there has not been a tension in the marketplace that competes between food and fuel. Now we have a marketplace that I've been up here for 2 weeks. I don't know what it cost. It was $144 a barrel when I came up the mountain. I think it was probably $7. So both of them have gone up a lot. But now we are out of balance. 20-1. I can guarantee you that there are forces of people who are saying, that looks like a good return on investment. Right? Anything you can do to take something and increase its value 20 times is a wonderful return on investment. This is not the scientist. This is not the environmentalist. This is the marketplace view. We've got 840 million automobiles in the world. The average income of an automobile owner is about $30,000 globally. We've got 2 billion people in the world that have incomes less than $3,000. What does that say about the marketplace? Who's got the money? So, I think that my sense is that we need to really keep in dynamic tension. I'm not saying biofuels make no sense, but it is important that we understand the macroeconomics around this. and that we realize that there is this dynamic tension, that if we just poo-poo, we're not being realistic. So in just one or two more minutes here, let's look at where we are today. The major three oils that people use for biodiesel production are rapeseed or canola oil, soybean oil, palm oil. According to FAO, international commodities prices for canola, average price 2005 was $669 per ton. Average price today of $1,457. It's gone 2.2 times. Soybean, same period, $545 to $1,394, gone up two and a half. Palm oil, $422 to $1,160, 2.75 times. So I have no time for the argument that says that biodiesel is not impacting food supply. I think that is just an absurd argument. The more interesting question is, are we going to live with it? And how long are we going to live with it? I have lobbied for biofuel support. But as day by day goes by and I see these prices change, it makes me sicker and sicker to think about the consequences. So I think that's the economic dynamic tension. Let me just say one more thing, and I'll let Kevin kind of pick up. Another interesting part of biofuels is they fit into our infrastructure so well. There's none of the discussions we were having yesterday around hydrogen. No new safety issues, no pipelines, different vehicles, fuel cells. It's another thing to throw in the hole. No investment required, except for maybe a dollar a gallon blender credit.
Yep. And a dollar a gallon sounds like less and less. So, if we start there where Brian left us, the cost of food is changing. The cost of food is changing for lots of reasons. It's changing in part because we're taking some food and turning it into fuel. It's also changing because fuel is getting more expensive, and it takes fuel to produce food. I don't know the latest statistic, but the last I heard, it was something over 2,000 miles. That's the average distance that a bite of food travels to get between my teeth. How does it get those 2,000 miles? Almost always petrol. And so if gas gets more expensive, food gets more expensive. And so we want to make sure that we think about food and fuel, and we think hard about biodiesel and ethanol, but we also recognize that food and fuel is not an issue that started with biodiesel and ethanol. It's an issue that existed at least as long ago as we started producing alcohol from food, but maybe even before that, because it's always taken energy to produce food, and it's always taken energy to deliver food. And that, I really appreciate how Brian connected this to yesterday. That's the question we have to ask. How do we want to use fuel in our food economy? How do we want to rank the importance of feeding people against the importance of keeping our energy infrastructure going? To talk about that question, I need to do what I promised I would do yesterday, and that's think about this weed that I keep throwing all around. You can hear environmental ethicists talk about we all the time. The usual question for environmental ethicists are about who and what we mean by we. So the usual question is, do we include non-human animals in we? Do we have a responsibility to orcas, to whales, to rotifers, to snail birds? That's a who or a what question. And that's a great question, but I take this line from Brian, that's a great question we're not going to talk about today. Because what I want to talk about when we talk about we is where and when. I want to talk about issues of time and space. That's the we I want to think about. And I get that that impulse to do where and when from the science of ecology. Simon Levin, a fairly important ecologist, has written that scale is the most important problem of ecology. And by problem, of course, he doesn't mean this keeps getting in our way. He means this is what we need to think about. This is what we need to devote our energy to. When ecologists talk about scale, this is going to be grossly oversimplified. What they're talking about is the grain, the resolution of their attention, and the extent of their attention. So if I'm an ecologist and I want to study a system, I have to first define, I have to make really clear, what size system am I going to study? Do I want to understand the Pacific Northwest, or do I want to understand 1 square meter of grass right out here? That's a very different extent. Now, I want to understand the Pacific Northwest. Probably we all do. It's nice to be here. I would love to know how it works. So why wouldn't you just have the biggest extent possible? Because of the other question, the grain, the resolution. Because the bigger your extent, the less detail you can get. And our digital cameras are getting good enough that we don't notice this too much anymore. But if you look at a photo that is of something really big and you try and make out a detail inside it, you see that there's a problem of resolution. Somebody taking a photo from space of Holden Village wouldn't be able to make out very clearly one individual, unless they had a really spooky satellite. In general, extent and resolution are a trade-off. The bigger your extent, the bigger the thing you're looking at, the less resolution, the less detail you get. So we have to make decisions. And for ecologists, those are where and when distinctions. It's about time and space. So it's not just the Pacific Northwest. It's also, do I want to understand this meter of grass and what it does this morning? Or do I want to understand it for the next century? And again, if I want to understand it for 100 years, it's going to be hard to take a measurement every second. I'm going to have to space out my measurements further. But if I'm just doing it for a couple hours, I can take lots of measurements. I've got a really high resolution. So time and space. We make choices about the temporal and spatial scale of our attention. Now, what I want to say is that we, as people thinking ethically, we as people thinking about what we must do when we don't know what we should do, also have to think about time and space scales. We have to think about how big is the we we're talking about, how big is the we we're concerned with, and for how long are we concerned with. So this is me adopting something that scientific ecologists do to environmental ethics, to say that there are scales of ethics, just like there are scales of scientific attention. And I'm going to give you 3 scales, because as you know, I love 3s. That's why I was willing to embrace Brian's triangle. We can think about these as concentric circles, maybe. And the smallest circle is the local. The smallest circle is the immediate. The smallest circle is one place over maybe the next year or so. Holden Village would fit inside this circle. And if what I want to do is make sure Holden is here next year so people can come here next summer, then this is the scale I'm thinking about. And I think that's worth thinking. That's a good scale. That's an important thing to think about. Will Holden be here next year? But of course, that's not the only scale we might think at. We can go out maybe one ring, and maybe the thing to call this is the national scale. Let's think about the United States of America. Let's think about the United States of America for the next generation. Will the United States of America be here and healthy for the next generation? Also, I think a really important question, a crucial question. But we can get even bigger. And this big scale is where environmentalists usually start. The other book that is in the bookstore, in case you're interested, is Larry Rasmussen's Earth Community, Earth Ethics. I want you to take a wild stab at those of you who haven't seen it. What do you think is on the cover of Earth Community, Earth Ethics?
Planet.
Earth from space. You can find lots of environmentalists writing about how it changed us when we saw that picture for the first time. Seeing the whole planet as one mass, as one body hanging in space. Seeing the home, the habitat for every creature we've ever encountered as one thing. That's this global scale. And environmentalists, as I say, usually start here, and for good reason. Because we're concerned about the whole globe, and we're concerned about its sustainability. In other words, for as long as we can figure out, we want it to last. We like the whole planet, and we like it for a really long time. That's the biggest scale of thinking. So, local. Why, if we like the planet so much, would we bother with the local?
Well, because some problems are local. And some problems are created when we try and go national or global when we should be local. So a big movement in environmentalist communities now is for community-supported agriculture, home gardens, pea patches that we've talked about some this week. That's a local argument. That's saying, don't get your food from 2,000 miles away. Get it from your own backyard. If you don't have a backyard or you can't get it from your backyard, get it from a farmer whose hand you can shake and whose eyes you can look into. That's a local argument. It's different from a national argument about food security or energy independence. Those are national arguments. Those are arguments that draw a border around our country and say, we need to take care of this place. So we need to make sure we have the energy we need. We need to make sure we have a secure supply of food. Both of those scales are different from the global. Both of those scales are different, I think, from the MANA argument, which is a global argument. As I understand what I'm learning from Professor Story, from Dan Erlander, we have a responsibility to believe and to act as though there is enough for everyone to eat. That's a global argument. That's a global perspective. Okay, so what does this have to do with we? The question is, where do you put yourself? Which we do you feel like you're a part of? And we're all going to say, well, I want to be all three. And we should want to be all three. But remember, the lesson I got from ecologists was, the bigger my extent, the less my resolution. And so there are choices to be made. There are difficult choices to be made. If you devote your life to growing your own food and to getting other people in your neighborhood to do the same, you have a little less energy, a little less social energy to pay attention to the globe. Now, maybe social energy isn't a limited category. Maybe we can expand it. Maybe we don't have to make final and ultimate choices, but we do have to make choices between these scales. By the way, I used to put a dot in the middle and make that I, but I really don't like that anymore. Because I was stupid when I did that. Because the whole point is, where do you see the I as belonging? Is the I encompassing this global? Do you see yourself as a global citizen, a national citizen, a local citizen? Some people see themselves as cosmic citizens. That'd be another circle. And some people, maybe too many people, don't even care about their local communities. And they would be this dot in the middle. But I don't like that dot, so I'm not drawing it anymore. Okay, so how does this help us talk about food and fuel? How does this help us talk about energy? Remember energy. If we don't keep this frame of energy, then all we're doing is throwing numbers and words at you and mounting up problem upon problem. Oh, I've got to worry about hydrogen, I've got to worry about biofuels, I've got to worry about climate change. That's not what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do is say, we can think about all of this in a coherent way, or at least a more coherent way, if we think about it in terms of energy. So, how does scale help us think about energy, help us think about food and fuel? The first way I think scale helps us think about an ethics of energy is it asks us, what's the scale of our care? What's the scale of our moral attention? Do we care for all beings on Earth? Do we care for every other human being on the Earth? Do we care for every citizen of this nation? Do we care for every citizen of this state? Do we care for everybody who's in Holden Village right now? Those are different scales of caring, of moral attention. That's a question of social energy. That's a question about who's the we to whom we are responsible. Who's the we that we feel a part of, that we identify with? Who's the we that we're committed to changing, to improving the world for? Those are scale questions. And the thing about social energy is that it's a question of, how am I using the energy I have and the energy of my communities? And also, how am I contributing to the energy I have and the energy of my communities? Because the great thing about social energy is we can create it. We can make more. Coming to Holden Village, and getting inspired and thinking, I'm going to go home, I'm going to do this, I've got to buy seeds, I've got to clear the yard, and I'm going to start planting something. Whatever you might be thinking, you're getting energy if you're getting excited. Hopefully, if you take a hike and you see something beautiful, you're getting energy from that, social energy that you can use to do something. So social energy is something we can create. That's how we change communities. But social energy isn't the only reason we need to think about scale. We also need to think about the scale of our natural energies. And I tried and tried to figure out a way that we create natural energy. And I said to Brian, this is going to be really exciting. I'm going to say, we can create social energy, we create natural energy. And he looked at me skeptical. And I said, we create natural energy because, you know, we could power. Have you ever seen Ed Begley Jr. on his bicycle powering his toaster? He's creating natural energy. They used to strap oxen to a wheel to grind flour. We were creating energy with a living being. And Brian said, but you have to feed Ed Begley Jr. and you have to feed the ox. What's that?
Thermodynamics.
And you lose efficiency.
Yes.
So I was so focused. I was so excited that Brian could pick up the book that I forgot about the oatmeal that it took to let him pick up the book. We can't create natural energy, at least not as far as I can figure out. Natural energy is a gift we get. A lot of it from the sun. The rest of it from, as I understand it, essentially the Big Bang. All of it, according to a theological frame I laid out day one, from God. But natural energy is what we get. So the questions about natural energy are, what are we using? And what are we leaving for others to use? Do we use energy on a local scale, a national scale, or a global scale? The we I'm talking about, me and people like me, people of relative comfort and security in the United States of America, we use energy on a global scale. We get oil from all over the world. We get natural gas from all over the world. We don't get coal from all over the world, but that's just because it's cheaper to get it here. If it was cheaper somewhere else, we'd go get it. We have no qualms about reaching across the world for our food, for our energy. So we're consuming on a global scale. And it's worth thinking about, if we're consuming on a global scale, does our moral attention, does our social energy match our consumption, our natural energy? Are we as morally concerned as we are consumptive? Brian said yesterday that one of the issues we were ignoring is that we are addicted to energy. I think this is really important. We are addicted to energy. And how are we addicted to energy? We're addicted to energy in not quite the way an addict is addicted to cocaine. Because cocaine, it's from the coca leaf, but it's processed in such a way that it's just a bad product for people to use in almost any setting. Cocaine is bad. To use cocaine is bad. So addiction to cocaine is a really big problem. Addiction to energy is also a really big problem, but the use of energy is not necessarily a problem. To live is to consume energy. We all consume energy. We're addicted to energy the way I'm addicted to donuts. There's nothing wrong with fat and sugar. Donut is, Brian told me, a great energy source. It's got lots of calories. That's great, right? So it would be okay if I had a donut every now and then, but I have a problem when I'm around there. It's not a problem that we use energy. The problem is that we use energy the way I use donuts, which is we want all there is and then we want to find more. So we're addicted to energy because we're taking something that is a gift from God, that is healthy, and we're using it in an unhealthy way. And that's what we need to talk about, that this scale of our consumption, our addiction that's always trying to push out the scale of our consumption, we want more, is not matched by our scale of moral attention that's asking, but should we get more? Are we taking it away from someone else? Are we depriving someone else of this energy by using it? So really quick, before we use all these frames and these ideas to talk about food or fuel and some other things we want to talk with y'all about, I want to mention an elephant in the room. Whenever somebody says there's an elephant in the room, my question is always, yeah, but which one? The elephant I want to talk about that's in this room
I'm sure for some people I've already talked to, is population.
Because some people have told me and have talked to Brian, want to say, okay, energy is interesting, but the bigger question is population. And as we talk about food for fuel, we want to throw it open to talk about, well, maybe this isn't an energy problem, maybe this is a population problem. There's just too many darn people. Really quickly, I want to say why we think energy is a bigger question than population. Population sort of appeared on the radar in the late 60s when a population ecologist named Paul Ehrlich wrote a book called The Population Bomb. How many people have read The Population Bomb? Okay. So the beginning of The Population Bomb, the first couple pages, is about Paul Ehrlich's first trip to Calcutta and this teeming mass of humanity. There were just so many people in every direction that he looked, and he was terrified. How can the resources we have possibly support this many people? We have an impending population bomb, he wrote in 68, I think it was. The problem's already started. We've got too many people. The Earth can't support the number of people it currently has on it, and we're just making more. Population is the central problem. Paul Ehrlich got a lot of flack. I think some of it for good reason. A lot of people noted that the way he framed this debate, and especially the way the debate got taken from him, was in an essentially racist direction. Because it said, the thing to worry about is these parts of the world where the birth rate is high. Here in the U.S., we pretty much replace ourselves, not quite, in fact, without immigration. So we're doing okay. The problem is where population is growing. Which ends up meaning the problem is people who don't look and act like me. Other people said, I'm not sure population is really the answer. I think maybe it's consumption. Maybe it's not a number, matter of how many people you have, but how much those people are consuming. Ehrlich, to his credit, took this seriously. And when he first wrote The Population Bomb, he essentially said, the impact we have on our environment is a direct result of our population. In the 80s, he started writing that the impact we have on our environment is a result of our population, our affluence, how rich we are, and our technology, how efficient we are. And so it's not just about the number of people, it's also about how much they're consuming and how they're doing it. 6 billion people still using wood for energy would be an even bigger disaster than what we've got now. So technology can be a good thing. But affluence, insofar as it raises consumption, is a worry, is a problem. So one of the ways Ehrlich framed this idea that consumption is the issue, not population, is he says the world that we currently live in could support 10 billion Gandhis and about 2,000 Donald Trumps. The issue is not how many there are, but how much they're consuming. Ehrlich is clever, rhetorically. Notice, he's been accused of racism. He chooses as his model of good citizenship, of a vegetarian who lived lightly on the land, an Indian. And he chooses a model of poor citizenship, overconsumption, a white guy. The point is that Ryan and I think our impact on the environment can be measured as our natural energy consumption plus our social energy consumption. Minus the social energy we produce. So we have the potential to have a positive impact. Now, I'm not a chemist, so I haven't written this well. We have the potential to have a positive impact in terms of creating social energy. But we've got no choice but to use some natural energy. But the question is not how many of us there are. The question is how much we're consuming, how addicted we are, and how much we're creating, how much we're helping, how much we're making things better. That's how I want to just say, that's how I want to begin if we want to end up having a discussion about population. But I also want to sort of throw open to lots of ways to discuss food and fuel and return to this manna idea, which I'm going to ask Brian to do before we throw it open. Okay. Yeah, I know you.
Well, how about we put different subscripts?
Ah, that's what you do. Is it SE Prime?
Yeah. You got the subscripts and they both go away. I really want to. We want to move into a conversation right now. And the question to frame the conversation is important. My first instinct that Kevin probably reasonably didn't like was, is manna a fantasy? So we probably won't go there. But I think it's an interesting discussion. I think if we look inside of ourselves, sometimes as we get involved in this argument, that that's what we really want. This is not possible, so we're not going to think about it. So maybe a way we frame this discussion is, where do we get the energy for manna? I think this is a reframe of what's the church's role. I will move on to a different question, but it's the same question. Where do we get the energy for manna?
Can you just say what manna?
I'm using manna in the Alan story context. He refers to the manna way as there will be food for all. He, you know, offhand last week mentioned that they have a policy at their church, which is an incredibly poor church in South Africa, that no one will leave the property hungry. Some days that means they feed 1,000 people at the church. The manna way. It's an interesting analogy because, you know, he's the only local one. I mean, the reason I think we hear anger in his voice a lot is that his local reality is very different from ours. Mm-hmm. So, where does the energy from manna come from? Let's talk about it. You gotta have an opinion, man. That's it. I waited for 5 seconds of silence. There will be a discussion. So, Vinia, can you start us?
Are you talking about social energy or natural energy?
What would you like to talk about?
Which is more important?
I think social energy is more important. Because that's what we can control. So, I would say that, you know, if we wanted to provide food for all, then we have to have the will to take action. And we have to live in an abundant society and practice that with our neighbors at any of the three levels. And so that begs the question of who is our neighbor?
Anybody else?
I think we also have to believe that we can change social energy. We often come to something like this and we all applaud and go, yeah. And we go home and say, I really can't. I really can't do anything. I don't have any effect on it. And it's that negative side of us that often drives us instead of, I can, I will, I must, I should. And so therefore we do community because I cannot alone do anything but my pea patch. But together, I can think, which is energy. I can speak, which is energy. I can write. I can do all of these energetic things, but not unless I continue to work on the negative side that draws me away from it.
Thank you.
There's a well. I guess the philosophy or the belief of Stephen Covey, who wrote Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, talked about the belief that there's enough for everybody. And he equated those who don't think that way, who think there's a limited, finite source, tend to be more reactive people. People who think that there is plenty for everybody, that the pie is big enough, tend to be more proactive. And if we kind of think that way, then believing and being proactive about this would be one of the ways of dealing with this, and not sitting back and waiting for it.
I don't mean to be argumentative this time, but you guys are doing a great job. You got two legs covered down here, but you're missing that get one up from the top, the economist. And the economists have a theory called theory of alternative cost, which states it may cost something to do something, but what does it cost if you don't do something? And you've got to address both those costs.
Well, that's good.
I love the frame that you guys have given us to have the discussion and the conservation of natural energy that you talked about, but I somewhat disagree with the infinite amount of social energy. I think we're kind of like the 60% or 20% what efficiency are we running at?
Mm-hmm.
And quite often as a society, we ignore that inefficiency that kind of you were talking about in personally in the small circle, and then maybe in the next circle out, we don't value education. We give a lip service, but we don't put our dollar to our words.
I want this to be a discussion, but I can't help but comment. I completely agree with it. And I don't think we've ever said social energy is infinite. It's changeable. I mean, there are days where my commitment to social change or social energy is zero, negative. I'm done. I've given all I can give. It's because I've invested my energy in other ways. But that's changing.
Well, it's something I struggle with, because maybe it is infinite if it comes from God.
Right.
It's my own pessimistic view that I have a limited amount, and I waste and toil with a lot of those with negative thoughts.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the way I'd ask the question is not, is it infinite, but could there be more? Can we create social energy? And I don't think that we can create all the social energy that we could possibly ever want. I think we can create more social energy than we have. That's all I can say.
And I think one really important thing that you both have touched on is that we do need to create more social energy. And I think sort of a counterintuitive way of doing that is to actually step back and be able to feed ourselves spiritually and to nurture each other, and that probably means for most of us working less. And I work with a nonprofit organization, Earth Ministry, and in the nonprofit world, it's very common for people to really put their full self into their work because it's something they really believe in. But I think the effectiveness issue is a really difficult question. I think for most of us, we would be more effective if we actually took the time to experience each other and experience the natural world, and then really sort of fuel that social energy in that way. But I think, and I'm not sure how we can make that happen, because it's not really a socially acceptable thing to say that we should all be working less, but my job.
It occurred to me yesterday, and this discussion today also, that it seems to me that there are probably only two places that social energy is created, and that is in the church and in the college classroom. And aside from that, I'm not so sure that social energy or conversation about these kinds of things happens. You don't have a Rotary Club that discusses environmental issues. You don't have a ladies knitting club or whatever that has these kinds of deep discussions. And that's what I think the role of the church is. The church has to be the creator of social energy, because those kinds of conversations don't occur anyplace else. They may occur to some limited degree in governmental agencies and associations, and certainly, you know, in sort of non-profit kinds of like Earth Ministries, for example, but that's a ministry. That's really, you know, that's very faith-based kind of an organization. And I sort of think that unless and until the church steps up to host these kinds of conversations, that it's not going to happen to any great extent.
You said you have to.
Well, you know, you've set some boundaries in what you want to do with your framing of what we're talking about. And we're looking at things in a very macro, okay? And we're talking about energy, social, and technology, all right? But when we get down to the church and some of the other things that we're doing, it really is we, and we is I, okay? And so we have to really input I into this thing, in your social, in your framing, all right? We can do a lot of little things, you know, just daily, you know. We're here in Holman Village, we're great practitioner of recycling, not wasting, not, trying to bring in things that we have to haul back out.
Okay.
And just from what we're doing every day, just admiring the flowers and saying, hey, that's a gift too from God. And so what I think one of the primary things that we got to refocus on is not to be too macro, but to be aware that the church body in itself is a social engine. It's an energy engine, okay? And but we can also be individually an engine. We can individually contribute. I can talk you into not to use plastic bags and grab a canvas tote bag instead of so we don't have to remake things all the time. Okay, and I sometimes think that sure, this is an education. We're here as an educational to expand and think, but we also need to have some way so that we feel like we're contributing or we're doing something. And I think that this is one of the things that we need to emphasize as well, not just as a church group, but as individuals within a frame of church group. So don't get it so big that you can't, that guy is, and hell, I'm an engineer. I'm a technocrat.
Okay. You saw that you had your hand up 10 minutes ago, and then way in the back,
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just going to say that I think social energy and the creation of social energy, the maximum, is in community. And community can take many forms, the church, whatever, but it has to be done in community. And I think we learn that from the Bible and the example of Jesus. So that's good.
Great. Right. I guess that kind of was similar point. I think we need to recognize the other institutions of community that create social energy, whether it's K-12 education, families, what have you, because we can't look at non-Christian people who, we can't look at non-religious people who haven't gone to college and say that they don't have social energy.
I guess I wanted to say more than church community, because but where does that community occur? Maybe I should have expanded beyond church. I think it does occur more, not exclusively, but more in faith-based, whatever that faith may be, institutions and or in community, whatever that community may be.
I was gonna go back to your question about manna for all, and what it triggered in me was a recollection of something Alan said earlier, that neither communism nor capitalism is adequate to provide the fullness of life for all people. So do I think that it is possible to have manna for all? Yes, but now I'm wondering, wow, is there a systemic change that needs to occur? So while we're working as individuals to recycle, to educate, to model, at the same time, do we need to be thinking about what is the system that will fulfill?
Yeah, that's a great question. You've been...
Well, it was already mentioned,
okay. But
I wanted to expand the weed. And the reality is that there are organizations like the Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society and the Environmental Defense Fund, and on and on and on. And those organizations, the Sierra Club, for example, has been doing these things and fighting on these issues for over half a century. And one of the delights for me in terms of Earth Ministry is that finally the church has begun to wake up to all of these things. But we have to bear in mind that these other organizations woke up a long time ago. We are Johnny-come-latelys.
Yeah, we're at the end of the time, so I'm going to, given the fact, if you don't know, full disclosure, Kevin and I are board members of Earth Ministry, so we are not in any way completely objective about
this. No, I can objectively tell you it's the greatest thing ever.
let me close with what I think is a story of social change. My wife and I lived out, I'm from the Northwest, but lived away for many years, came back about 5 years ago, and started looking for a faith voice in the environmental community. I think my lens is only slightly rose-colored. At that point in time, 5 years ago, I felt like when I talked to a senator or a legislator or tried to sort of get any traction at all around creating a Christian voice in the political establishment, the result was, I was just absolutely surprised. You're a Christian. You want to talk about environmental stuff? The frame was just absolutely unknown, at least in Washington State. Many folks in Earth Ministry have been working on that for a long time, but creating the base social energy. But what has happened in the last 5 years is we now have a seat at the table. And we are sitting there with the Sierra Club, with People for the Puget Sound, with the Audubon Society, with the Mountaineers, helping shape that policy. And so if any of you have any sort of notion of needing a community to help you step into that fray, go. So let's stop there. Hope to see you tomorrow to talk about nuclear power.